My dear brethren and sisters, it is good to see some brethren amongst us, although obviously this morning we are going to be addressing ourselves chiefly to those sisters who have been good enough to come along here this morning and to share this occasion with us. And it is an occasion that we have looked forward to, sisters, because it is somewhat of a break for us in the middle of our effort. We are here, perhaps slightly more informal than what we might be on a study session in the evenings, and I hope that what we have to say this morning will be of some profit and benefit to you. We're going to be giving you a little bit of a mixture, just a little bit of exposition here and there, some repetition of those things that we've already said in our previous sessions, particularly for the benefit of those who were not with us, and also some practical, hopefully informed advice from the Word of God, which might help us as sisters to meet the requirements that are laid upon us by our God. I don't know whether any of you would have expected that I would be able to stand up here this morning and to put my finger upon a multitude of verses in the Bible which would indicate to you exactly what sort of work the sisters are going to be doing in the kingdom. Because if you thought that I could do that, then you would have thought I could perform a miracle. And of course, no one can do that. And I think most of you are aware that that is the case. I don't know of any particular place in the Word where you can actually point to a verse that says that the immortalized sisters will be doing this or that. What we've got to try and do is to involve ourselves in informed speculation and as best we can assess from the responsibilities of the present what might be the future career of those sisters who are glorified at the time of judgment and go forth with the Lord Jesus Christ to perform with him the work of the future age. Now you recall we mentioned in our session last evening that the first work that will involve many of us, and probably most of the sisters here, in one way or another, is immortal parenthood. That will be the first work that many of you will have to perform. And immortal parenthood is going to be a remarkable experience, is it not? Now, if you did think to put your event subsequent notes in this morning and brought them along with you, you might like to join me on page 37. For those of you who don't have the notes, that's no problem. You'll have to do something just a little bit harder than reading, and that's listening to someone out front reading. I know it takes a little bit of concentration, but I want you to just go through with me the words of Brother Roberts, which I referred to last evening, from The Ambassador, volume 3, page 185. You'll find those words quoted in the notes in the last paragraph on page 37. And we quote, "As to children who may be alive when the Lord returns and sends for the members of his household, the question is, will not provision be made for the household of the faithful? If we are to judge from the deity's operations in the past, we are justified in expecting that this will be so. Respect has always been shown to the kindred of those who have been the objects of divine regard. Noah's family is one instance, Lot's family another. His sons-in-law were, by command of the angels, invited to escape the impending judgment, but laughed the invitation to scorn. Rahab's family was spared from the destruction that befell Jericho. Is it not possible that similar favour will be shown when the greatest judgment of all arrives? Is it not possible that households may be invited to accompany the saints eastward? As a matter of course, the saints alone are called to judgment, and they alone enter the kingdom of God in the sense of obtaining the life, honour and glory of it. But mortal subjects will have to be provided for, as well as kings and priests. And is it not possible the saints may have a commission to secure among these a place for such of their kindred as shall have to leave home and country for the seat of the new power, there to shelter in the king's refuge until the judgment is overpast, and afterwards to settle among the tribes of Israel as strangers sojourning in the land, to whom a portion will be divided. He quotes from Ezekiel 47 and verse 22, and then adds, if so, all difficulty about the children would be at an end. Now, we suggested to you last evening, and we only had a very brief opportunity to refer to Ezekiel 47, but it does give us some indication of where our children will find a place in the purpose of deity when the Lord returns, because many of them are going to be babes in arms. But I want you to join me again, sisters, in Ezekiel 47. I'm not making this a matter of repetition because I haven't got anything else to say. There's a lot that I cannot afford to say this morning because of the absence of time. But I do think that this is one issue, one question, which does concern most of you who are either mothers or grandmothers. And though we did say something about it last evening, I do want you to have a look again at Ezekiel 47, verses 22 and 23. We read, in the context of the division of the land after Armageddon, when it has been cleansed by a diligent operation by the Jews who have been the survivors of Armageddon, when that land has been cleansed, it will be prepared, of course, for the division that will be necessary even before the temple is underway in construction. Because, you see, the temple cannot be built until such time as there is a holy oblation, until such time as there has been a division of the land, so that people know where they've got to go and where they can't go. So once the land has been divided and the Jews have been settled, the temple can be built without any interruption. And so this is a very early work in the 40 years between the war of Armageddon and the establishment of the kingdom, or the opening of the kingdom age, the 1,000-year reign of Christ. And so we read in the 22nd verse of Ezekiel 47, and it shall come to pass that ye shall divide it by lot for inheritance unto you. The reference, of course, is to those Jews who will have been purified by the events of Armageddon. A fountain of righteousness will be opened for their cleansing, of course, in Zion. And when they are purified, they will be settled in that land. They are to be divided in inheritance by lot. But then is added the words, and to the strangers that sojourn among you, which shall beget children among you, which means they are mortal because they are marrying and bearing children. So they're not the immortals, those of us who are Gentiles, and that's all of us. No reference to Gentiles who have a possession in the land. We will have a possession, of course, with Abraham in that land. In fact, our possession, like Abraham's, is the entire world, centered chiefly in that land. This is a reference then, not to immortals, but to mortals who are marrying and bearing children. What does it say about them? And they shall be unto you as born in the country among the children of Israel. They shall have inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel. And as we pointed out last evening, sisters, this cannot be a reference to ordinary Gentiles who might, for some reason, either through fleeing from the judgments that will be carried on in the 40 years between Armageddon and the opening of the kingdom, have fled from their countries into the land of Israel for some sort of refuge. It can't be a reference to them, because Zechariah 14 says that Yahweh will not have the Canaanite, the Gentile, in his house or in his land. He will not have them. They have got to have become Israelites indeed to find a place in that land. And if they were Gentiles, as obviously the strangers of these verses are, then they have got to become like Israelites to be counted as one born in the land. And when the seed is counted, Psalm 87 tells us, and that's a reference to you and me, when the seed is counted, we, brothers and sisters, who are Gentiles, or should I say once were Gentiles in the flesh, will have been counted as though we were born in Zion. The children of Zion. You and me. And so it's got to be a reference to a similar class in that time subsequent to Armageddon. Who then can it be? Well, by a process of removing possibilities, of eliminating possibilities, it can only refer to one class of people. It refers to the children of those Gentiles who have been immortalized and go forth with the Lord Jesus Christ as part of Yahweh Sabaoth. It's a reference, brothers and sisters, undoubtedly to your young children and to mine, who will not have the opportunity, perhaps, or most certainly, will not have the opportunity to grow up into the age of responsibility and that time when they can make a decision for themselves about the truth that will be found in our care at the return of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now I find that a matter of tremendous consolation, because I know from that verse that Yahweh cares for my children. And that's an incentive for me to do my part to ensure that nothing will impede their chance of growing up in that land, of finding for themselves a partner in that land amongst the other mortal Christadelphian children, of bearing children themselves. And you see, by the time that the kingdom is open, brothers and sisters, let's say Christ comes this afternoon, I've got a 4.5-year-old girl. By the time the kingdom is opened and the nations have been subdued, she will be nearly 55 years of age. And while we know that in the kingdom age life will be extended and there will be longevity and the days of Methuselah will return, Isaiah 65 tells us that, she will still be 55 years of age, which means that she will have been able by that time to marry and produce her own children, and her own children will have reached the age of responsibility. And so you see, my prospective grandchildren are going to grow up as mortals in that glorious time when the land is being prepared for the reception of those Jews who are being brought back by Elijah. And when Elijah brings them back, brothers and sisters, and the Jews come from the east across what remains of the Jordan and up the valley of Achor, a door of hope, my grandchildren could well be standing on the sides of that valley witnessing the events of Psalm 24. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, even lift them up, the King of Glory might come in. I know that psalm is likened to the time when the Lord will make himself known to the Jews after Armageddon, but I also believe it has a reference to the return of the Jews under Elijah. And as they make their way up that valley, my children and my grandchildren could be there, brothers and sisters, that they might witness those glorious events. You know what? They will have had their possession in that land before the bulk of Jewry. Now that's a privilege, isn't it? That's an enormous privilege. And that's the work, sisters, that you're doing now, which will determine ultimately your future career in the kingdom. Because one of the first responsibilities laid upon immortal parents will be to ensure that their children, who are taken with the Lord Jesus Christ into that land to settle in it, that they will have to be educated in the ways of the truth, that they might be able to bear fruit themselves in their own lives. Now we are endeavouring to do that work today with our children. In the future, brothers and sisters, when we are immortal, we won't make quite so many mistakes, will we? In fact, we won't make any mistakes. And you know what? I think I can speak for you when I say I am really looking forward to that day when I can't make any mistakes. And that's our hope, isn't it? And we're going to be there if it is our present desire to make as few mistakes as is possible. And so what I'm going to try and present to you this morning is that our present responsibilities are an indication in some way of our future career in the kingdom age, particularly for those sisters who are here, who are in that situation of having young children, and even for those, as I said, who may be grandmothers and who have a degree of responsibility in the raising of their grandchildren. There will be no marriage, of course, for us who go past the judgment seat of Christ. Marriage will then be an undesired and an unnecessary institution. We will have entered upon a greater marriage, brothers and sisters, than that which we have now. A marriage with our Lord Jesus Christ. And we will not have the same desire for the companionship of another person, a single person, that we now have. Our companionship will then be with his body, which will be a multitudinous companionship. And a companionship, brothers and sisters, that will exceed the desire or the love of women or of husbands. It will far exceed that. That's the hope of the future. But though that might be the case, we will still have to go about the task as immortal parents of raising our children who may yet be very young. For instance, some of you sisters may well bear children after Christ has returned. That's a very real possibility, isn't it? You may have to give birth to your next child at Mount Sinai. No need to get worried about it. These days, you know, we get very concerned. You've got to go to hospital to have your baby. Make sure everything's germ-free. You're very concerned about that. But there were thousands of children born in the wilderness when Yahweh brought Israel out of Egypt. And they were born very well. Because, you see, they were trained midwives. The faithful midwives of Exodus chapter 2 who refused to perform the edict of Pharaoh, and when the children were born, made sure that they were preserved from the hands of Pharaoh's violent soldiers who were going around smashing heads and throwing babies into the river. You know what, brothers and sisters, and particularly sisters, those faithful midwives are going to be there at Sinai, and they will not have forgotten what they learned. They will not have forgotten their trade. Yahweh, the faithful creator, will restore them. They will still have the same abilities that they possessed before. So you need not concern yourself if perhaps that is a possibility that you may have to give birth at Sinai. That will be looked after. Yahweh has made provision for all things, and we can rest assured in that. And so now, brothers and sisters, is a training ground. If those midwives are going to have their abilities and their qualifications used, and there's no doubt about that, then what about your abilities? What about your qualifications that you're now developing? Yes, sisters, they can and will be used in the kingdom age. And that's the point we're going to make this morning. And you know what? The kingdom age is going to be an age of discipline. It's not going to be an age where children are allowed to work on their parents or to get away with things in the process of education and basically become the equal to the teacher. It will not be an age where children will come home and say, I'm going to have my own mind and my own thoughts, and I will not listen to what you say, Mum and Dad. It's going to be an age of discipline. In fact, such severe discipline that the law of Moses provided for, that if children or adults are rebellious, they will be put to death. That is, incorrigibly rebellious. If you cannot do anything with them, they will perish. The world today would be horrified by that. They won't even put to death murderers. Your jails in this city are full of people who ought to be dead, but they're not, because the world in which we live has been affected by the unclean spirits, hasn't it? Liberty, equality and fraternity. Forget about those who have been murdered or maltreated, and leave those who did it alive and let them out of jail in 2 years' time. That's the spirit of the age. It will not be so in the kingdom. It will be an age of discipline. And sisters, it is up to you now to develop certain qualifications in that regard that you can carry into the kingdom, because your role is unquestionably going to be related to the domestic issues of the kingdom age. No doubt about that. That's your area. The domestic issues of the age. And it's going to be an enormous task for you. And you might think to me, well, I'd rather be with Christ going out and doing this or doing that and securing that nation or going over here and doing that. Sisters, your role is going to be, perhaps, if we might say this, even more important than that. It might not be necessarily a work of subjugation. It will be a work of construction, of rebuilding. And a whole generation of people will have to be completely re-educated. There has got to be some enormous changes overtake this world. And you, sisters, will be involved in that work. Right at the grassroots level of it, in the homes, where there will have to be a total reversal of attitudes and of approaches, right down to the very nitty-gritty issues of daily life in which you are deeply involved. And so you see, now is a time of preparation for that. And your re-education of the survivors of Armageddon is not going to be an easy work, but it's going to be an intense one. And you're going to be deeply involved in that for a long, long time. And there the foundations will be laid for the kingdom. And you know, when we talk about the kingdom, let's get this in mind. Though it will be relatively utopian, virtually utopian in its conditions, it is still going to be a very practical business, you know, the kingdom. A very practical business. Because there will be mortals, and mortals have to eat. They have to clothe themselves. Have to put something on their feet. And therefore they need to work and to labour. They need to conduct their lives in an orderly fashion. As you and I go about our lives, we have three meals a day. Someone's got to provide the food. You can't go to a corner shop in the kingdom and buy yourself a fast food meal. Corner shop will not be there. There's not going to be the industrialisation or the commercialisation that we see around us today. No doubt about that. Because you see, if you have a corner shop that makes fast meals, then that is basically like a factory, isn't it? And factories are interdependent. Who makes all the bits and pieces that you get the meal in, the plastics and all that sort of thing? Another factory. And for that factory to run, you've got to have another factory, and another factory, and another factory. Take one factory out of it and the whole lot collapses. And there's going to be no factories in the kingdom. Men will go back to an agricultural way of life. They will grow their own produce. They will clothe their own children. And they will set about that task under your direction and mine. The men will have their responsibilities, unquestionably, in teaching the men folk of the kingdom age how to conduct their business affairs in relation to providing for their family. I don't mean by that business in the sense of commercial business, but the business of life. And the women, brothers and sisters, will have to be instructed in how to raise their children and provide the domestic things of life by you sisters. So what you're doing today in accordance with divine principles in your home is extremely important in relation to the work of the future. As I said, the age is going to be an age of discipline. And that means, brothers and sisters in particular, that we have to be very cautious about letting into our homes the spirit of this age. And the spirit of this age is to let your children get away with almost everything. That's not going to happen in the kingdom. You remember the words of Proverbs 29, which we quoted on Sunday morning for those of you who are here. A child left to himself brings his mother to shame. His mother to shame. And it's the mother, sisters, who has the first and primary role in relation to disciplining the children, because she's the one that's with them all day. I go to work for a few hours a day, but I'm not there in the day when the children are tired and miserable and when they want to get their own way. It's up to my wife then to do that of disciplining, and she would need, as you need to be, positive and firm in your guidance of the children. And I see examples
Not only do I see those examples in my own life, in my own ecclesia, but when I travel around, and I'm not talking about Adelaide in this regard, I haven't been here long enough to see very much, I see examples of sisters today who do not undertake disciplining of their children in the scriptural way. And you know what? They're suffering because of it. And discipline is not to be left just to one party of the marriage. It ought to be in the hands of both parties. And where there is cooperation between husband and wife, you will have a degree of success. We must be united, sisters, with our husbands in the work of discipline. It's not really good enough to say when the husband comes home, well, he's been a brat today, do something with him. Because the husband says, well, I didn't see it, I don't know how serious it was. You've got to do something with those children during the day, while they're under your care, particularly when they are very young. The husband, when he's around, should take over that role. But there's got to be cooperation, brothers and sisters. You know what? I'll give you an example. It's only just recently, and I won't mention any names, and I don't want you even to try and guess who I'm talking about, and you wouldn't know them anyway. But recently, we had an example of this which stuck out so clearly that everybody could see it. There was an occasion when, at a recent camp, study camp, when a sister who is trying to do her best raising her children and has already lost three of her girls to the world and has got two more to go and one is already three quarters gone, disciplined her child, smacking it only lightly, and her husband turned around, he'd been in the truth for a long time, and he said to his wife, mind you, don't you ever do that again. Quite publicly, to his wife in front of the child. Don't you ever do that again. That brother will lose all his children. You know what? He acknowledged that to me on the phone a short week ago. And yet you can't tell him otherwise. No cooperation in discipline. Absolute disaster in the home. Well, I was recently in another place, brothers and sisters, when another case came to my attention. Not as serious, but it illustrates the importance of not being deceived by the spirit of our age. We happened to get into discussion with a brother and a sister who have adopted a child. They've waited a long time for children. A little boy. And they were talking to me about how they were trying to discipline the child. And we were swapping, you might say, points of advice. And they made the statement that they felt that they were being reasonably severe on the child. I didn't see evidence of that while I was there. And the child, who was 19 months of age, did as all children that age do. But when you told him that he couldn't have this or he couldn't have that and he ought to go and do this, he screamed his lungs out because he wanted his own way. And finally, after three or four examples of that, the mother was moved to smack him. Not very hard, but with a hand, which is the wrong thing. And to put something in it, the Bible says. Put something in it. A shebet masira. A rod of correction. That's the divine ideal. Anyway, she smacked him with a hand. And the little boy screamed even louder. So she grabbed him and said, oh, you poor dear, your feelings have been hurt. His bottom ought to have been hurt, sisters. And if she'd done that, she might have saved herself an awful lot of trouble in time to come. I couldn't tell her that. How could I, after talking with them about bringing up children and having them say that they thought they were severe on their child? I just couldn't bring myself to say, well, look, you're not severe, you're weak. Couldn't do it. But I went home, sisters, and I determined that I would not let the spirit of the age enter my life more than it has. And my wife used to say that I was a little bit too severe on my eldest girl. You know my eldest girl, you know why. She used to say I was a bit severe. I smacked her when she was 3 months of age. Some of you sisters will think that's brutality. I think now that it was too young. The third child's got smacked at 6 months of age, and she's in line for a bit more. You see, I'm softening up. And I'm wondering whether or not when we have a fourth child, God willing, will I even get weaker? Because all of us are in some way affected by the spirit of this age. Brothers and sisters, let's make sure that if there are changes needed in our life and the way we conduct ourselves in relation to discipline and cooperation in the home, that we have the courage and the determination to make those changes. Now take a bit more of a positive issue. It is critical that sisters play a role in the instruction of their children every day that they have them under their care. I know it's common practice these days for children to get to 3 or 4 and to go off to kindergarten or whatever. I'm not going to say that that's right or wrong. My children are not going to school, kindergarten or anything else until the last moment. I am not going to give my children into the arms of Molech until I am forced to by the laws of this state. And I will try and find the friendliest Molech that I can. As it may, that's my attitude, it might not be yours, that doesn't really matter. The one thing is certain, we will never save our children from the arms of Molech unless we educate them very early in the things of the truth. And that's a work, sisters, in which you've got to be involved while the husband may be at work. And it's a work that you've got to do when the husband is around the home. And we have developed a practice in our Christadelphian society which is extremely important. And that is the practice of doing daily Bible readings in the home. It must be maintained. But I'll tell you something, I'll make a confession. We weren't able to have children for 10 years. We were very busy doing this or that in those years. We decided that we would get more profit out of our readings by doing them privately. And we did. When children came along, we looked at the situation and said, well, we've got to start doing something for the children. And it was very, very difficult to make a start. Because you get into a habit, don't you? After 10 years of doing it one way, you get into a habit, you get into a rut. And it's difficult to get yourself out of that into another practice of life. And to sit down every night of the week after tea, doesn't really matter when you do it, providing it's organised. After tea is a good idea. Before Bab's got to go to his study or to go to a meeting or whatever. You get your Bibles out around the table and you do a reading at least with young children. We choose the best of the three readings because the children are young. And as the children grow older, you increase the readings. And you involve them in reading those chapters of the Bible that can sometimes be embarrassing, sisters. But the world is going to teach them a lot more embarrassing things than that. And the Bible is there that we might use it as an instrument of education to combat the evils of the world. And so as they get older, you increase the level and the extensiveness of the readings that are done. But it's up to the sisters to provide the atmosphere and the environment in which that can be done. And when the meal is over, and if you've got young children, it takes some of those young children a long time to get through their meals. I've sometimes gone from the table a half an hour before my oldest girl or my second girl has finished at tea. And sometimes you can find an excuse not to get back to the table. It's up to the sisters to do something about that and to ensure that there is some sort of organisation in the home which allows everybody at some given time to sit down together around that table and for Dad to take over the role of leadership, which is rightfully his, and to begin the readings before he does that with a prayer, a family prayer, seeking Yahweh's blessing upon the development of the family, and then to do something about explaining some of the simpler issues of the chapter that is read. And then we find it a very helpful thing to ask the children the questions out of the instructor, and to try and teach them, even in a parrot fashion, some of those things, that they might learn the principles of the truth at an early age. Maybe, with God's blessing, we will instill in their mind something which will repel the evils of the world that they will inevitably experience when they go to the schoolyard. And maybe we will be blessed, sisters, with not having to see our children enter into that horrible environment. I'm hopeful of that, as I've said already twice in this special effort. So we need then to do something about that. It depends on you, sisters, to ensure that the domestic situation is so organised that opportunities are provided for the readings to be done. And you should obviously work in cooperation with your husband in that regard. Now you'll say to me, there'll be some in this audience today who will say, well look, you're talking about ideals. And the realities of human life are that because we are weak and because we've got certain problems, that we rarely reach the ideals. That's right. There are some of us who've got problems. But you know what? We do what we do, not because I happen to have made that decision, sisters, but because I've observed those ideals in operation in other people's homes. And those other people's homes are sometimes the homes of brethren and sisters who would never even begin to compare themselves with others who are known to be in possession of more knowledge in the truth. And yet they know what to do to raise their children and to create an environment of positive growth. And I have learnt from them, both in that matter and in the matter of discipline. And we can learn from each other, can we not, in that regard. It's not impossible, sisters. It is not impossible to so organise your home that those things are done. But what it does require is determination to ensure that it is done consistently. Now while I'm talking about practical matters, I thought we might just go back a couple of pages in Ezekiel 40 to 44, that we might pick up a matter which is in connection with children in the kingdom. In Ezekiel 44, certain requirements are laid down about those who would have service and opportunities to remain in that land in the process of it being prepared for the kingdom age. And laws are laid down which would be required of those in that land through the kingdom age. I hope that this is not a sensitive matter. I am a little sensitive, seeing it's a sister's class, but I thought that it is a matter that has risen where we live, and a number of brethren and sisters have expressed their ignorance on the point, and were glad that someone said something about it. Now, quite frankly, I was also a little ignorant on this point a little while ago, so I'm really passing on to you something that has come to my attention and has been forced upon my attention since we have been in the process of having a family. We haven't had to concern ourselves with this matter because we haven't had any boys yet. In verse 9 we read of Ezekiel 44, thus saith Adonai Yahweh, no stranger, and you remember we were talking about the strangers who would have their inheritance in the land in chapter 47, your children and mine, no stranger, uncircumcised in heart, nor uncircumcised in flesh, shall enter into my sanctuary of any stranger that is among the children of Israel. Now we know, sisters, don't we, that circumcision counts for nothing today. Nothing. There may be some medical benefits in having your children circumcised. The medical profession would challenge that today. We know differently because Yahweh told Israel to be circumcised, and there was not just one reason for that, there were many. I will put none of these diseases upon you if you observe my statutes, and circumcision was predominant amongst those. Now, I don't know what you've experienced here in South Australia, but it is very difficult in Queensland to find a general practitioner who will circumcise a male child. It's a fact. We've had brothers and sisters who have had a male boy, a male child, a little boy, whom they wanted circumcised. And they've had a job to find a general practitioner who will circumcise the boy. And they thought to themselves, well, maybe the medical profession is right, maybe we won't bother. Well, just a point, a practical point. If Christ comes today, and you've got a little boy, he's going to be 10 years of age, or older, when he's taken into the land. And if he's going to be in that land and find a possession there, ultimately, amongst the children of Israel, and will frequent the temple, that he might mark well the bulwarks of that house as it's built, that he might learn to count, to read and to understand divine principles as he sees that temple constructed, he's not going to be allowed into it unless he's circumcised. Now if I was you, my advice would be this, that if you have trouble with a GP who says, I won't circumcise your boy because he might come back in 20 years' time and say, I want it reversed, and that's what's happening in our age. That's why doctors won't do anymore. Too many people wanting it reversed. I'd suggest to you, sisters, that you find someone to circumcise him. Because if I want to make a choice, if I get a boy, whether I will circumcise him as a 7 or 8 day old child, or when he's 10 or older, I know what choice I'm going to make. It's a matter of pain and suffering, isn't it? You're going to make the pain and suffering as least as possible, then do it when they're a baby, because it's going to have to be done later on. That's just a practical matter, which I said, as I said, I didn't want to make it too sensitive, but I think it may be of some assistance to those younger sisters amongst us. I was going to spend some time, sisters, on talking about the effect of the unclean spirits upon us. I think we've said a little bit about that already this morning. There are a number of tests in which you can give yourself a brief examination as to whether or not the spirit of our age in connection with women has affected your mind in some way. Maybe we might just mention those in passing. You might ask yourself, sisters, whether or not you feel any sense of envy for working women. Unquestionably, your neighbours, many of them, would be working. And you will have seen that they've got 2 cars, usually new ones. They can afford all the nice furniture. She's always got a different dress on. Her wardrobe needs to be extended another 12 feet because she's always buying new dresses. Because she's got her own income. Mind you, forget about the kids. The latchkey children are left to look after themselves from 7:30 in the morning until 5:30 at night. Never mind that. That's a problem for the future. And they leave it for the future. And your children and mine have to suffer that, and we're suffering it today in the schoolyard. Well, do you have any sense of envy for those women who have a career outside the home? Does the thought enter your mind when you're doing the dishes or the washing or scrubbing the floors? Oh, look, I wish I could give this away and have a career for myself. That's how the world is going on, isn't it? There's reason for us to question ourselves in that regard. Do you envy those who've got the money to spend? Secondly, is there any sense in which you grow irritable at the fact that your husband is not doing enough around the home domestically? And it is the age, isn't it, sisters, when women in the home expect more of their husbands than women did 30 or 40 years ago. Where I work, there are one or two cases where the woman goes to work and earns the salary, and the man is at home. Husband is at home looking after the children. And that's a fact. I work with women who do that. And moreover, I work with many more women who demand equality in the home. And if they do the dishes tonight, husband will do them tomorrow night, or there will be no dishes. And they must have equality. I'll change one nappy, you change the next. Otherwise we don't get it changed. That's the sort of spirit of our age. Now I just wonder, I'm not suggesting that husbands should not do anything in the home. A lot of brethren have been surprised at this, but I've changed a lot of nappies in my time, and I'm willing to do it. I've had brethren say to me, "You're mad." I'm not mad. I haven't been affected by the unclean spirits. I think that husbands should do a little around the home to give some support to their wife. But when it gets to a question of demanding equality, demanding that the husband do this or do that, then there is danger. And the women of this world have grown irritable about their husband not doing enough domestically. Just worthwhile asking yourself that question. Let's come to a more serious issue, if that's possible. Do you ever think, sisters, that the sisters of the Ecclesia could do a better job in those roles in the Ecclesia that are normally the province and scripturally the province of brethren? You recall I mentioned that there are Ecclesias today who do have sisters doing what I'm doing here. I've just recently read an article, at least scanned an article, which was a summary of an address given by a sister at a conference. A Christadelphian conference. And you know as well as I do that the spirit of our age, the unclean spirits of equality and fraternity, have seen women strive and attain equality in the church outside. And as we said on Sunday morning, it is happening in the brotherhood. Do you ever have any sense, sisters, any sense of feeling in your mind that the brethren are not doing a good enough job and the sisters would be able to do better? I hope that that has never come into your mind, because if it hasn't, then the unclean spirits have not affected you, and that's a really good thing. I want to show you an example of a sister who had the right spirit. 1 Peter chapter 3. Now you could probably quote this passage back to me standing on your head. And moreover, you'll probably turn the page and say, have a look at verse 7. Well, we've had occasion to look at verse 7 before. It's not verse 7 that concerns us at the moment. It's verses 1 to 6 of the 1st of Peter chapter 3. Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection. The word subjection is in the middle voice in the Greek. You know what the middle voice means, don't you? You've got active voice, you've got passive voice. We've learned about that on Sunday afternoon. In the Greek, you've got middle voice. In the middle voice, it means that you do something to or for yourself. In other words, Peter is saying, it's something that's got to happen, got to be within yourself. Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection. It's a decision that's up to you, sisters. Don't expect a husband to impose that. You've got to make the choice. Be in subjection to your own husbands. But if any obey not the word, they may also without a word, as it should read, not the word. You don't win converts to the truth. And he's talking about sisters who've got husbands outside the truth. You don't win converts to the truth without the Bible. The Bible is the basis of our faith. So he's not saying that. What he's saying is that the husbands who are not in the truth might well be won to the truth, that is to look at the Bible, by the way of life of their wives who speak no words but do many actions. By the sheer example, they are compelled on occasions to look into the truth. That's what he's saying. While they behold your pure or chaste behaviour, coupled with godly fear, whose adorning, let it not be the outward adorning of plaiting the hair and of wearing of gold or of putting on apparel, which we all do to some degree, but let it be the hidden, not woman of the heart, but man of the heart. Who is the man of the heart? Hidden away in your heart, sisters. In Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 17, Paul talks about Christ as being the hidden man of the heart, having Christ in our hearts by faith. He's the hidden man of the heart. In that which is not corruptible, he goes on to say, even the ornament of a meek and a quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God, of incalculable price. You can't value it. In the sight of God, it is of great price. For after this manner in the old time, the holy women also, who trusted in God, and there's your key as to how to get the meek and quiet spirit, it's a trust in God, so that when God says, sisters, I want you to be subject to your husbands and to labour in the home for the benefit of your family, and to so order your lives that you refuse to adopt the spirit of the age, you trust that. Women of the world don't. They demand a pocket full of money. They demand equality. No trust in that. It's what I can get, and I'm going to get it. And don't you stand in my way, or I'll wave the Family Law Act in your face, and I'll get it somewhere else. That's what they say, isn't it? So he goes on to say, the women of old time who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well and are not afraid of any consternation. Sisters, who was Sarah? She was the half-sister of Abraham, wasn't she? Now let me tell you something about families. It's a strange fact of human life that in families, male and female, that is brothers and sisters, regard themselves as equals. You try and tell my sister she's not equal to me. Isn't that right? And I suppose so it should be. Strange fact, but it's a fact of life, that brothers and sisters in the one family see themselves as equals. And when the inheritance comes up, and my parents have got no inheritance, but never mind, when the inheritance comes up, you just see whether the sisters are prepared to say to their brothers in the flesh, well, okay, well, you have the lot. And in matters of domestic issues, it's the same, isn't it? Natural sisters regard themselves as being basically equal with their natural brothers. Here was a woman who married her brother. Half brother, but a brother nevertheless, in the same family. And that was a no different age in what we live in that sense. She had the same human feelings that you and I experience, and therefore it was an intense problem in Sarah's life to be subject to her husband. You know what her name was? Sarai, which means dominating. And the women of this world want to dominate. And it's not in the nature of humankind for a natural sister to allow her natural brother to dominate her. She may not want to dominate him, but she will not allow herself to be dominated by him. And yet here we have a woman whose name was changed by Yahweh, not by herself, but by Yahweh, because she was at heart a woman who had a meek and quiet spirit. And Yahweh saw her as a princess, dependent upon the prince, for the fact that she was a princess, a prince in waiting, a future king of the world. We know who he was. So, my dear sisters, what we are being told here, a very simple lesson, isn't it? That Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, if you make the same decision, if you do well. Wasn't easy for her to do that. Not necessarily easy for you either. But she did it. And when it says that, that she called him Lord, that doesn't necessarily refer to Genesis chapter 18, verse 12, where we read that when the angels came to Abraham and they said to Abraham, your wife will have a child at this time next year. And Sarah laughed in her heart and said, shall I, being aged, have a child, my Lord also being beyond it? It's not a reference necessarily to that verse. You see, what Peter is saying is that this was part and parcel of Sarah's whole attitude. It wasn't just on one occasion she called Abraham Lord, sisters. She regarded him as her Lord from the day she married him. She had conceived of the problems that she would encounter. And to marry her brother would have required a decision about that. And so her whole life was given in subjection to Abraham in the way required by Scripture. And it's not the sort of subjection the world talks about, is it? It is a cooperation between husband and wife, a recognition of their status in the sight of deity, the husband being the head and therefore having upon him the enormous responsibility of being Christ in the home. And the sister seeing herself as the bride of the bridegroom and having upon her the responsibilities that the great bridegroom looks for in his bride. It was an act of cooperation between the two. And when you do turn the page to verse 7, this is what you find. Advice to the husbands. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge. Not all husbands do that. But it's required of us, husbands, to do that. To dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honour unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, as being heirs together of the grace of life. Now, of course, there is a certain grace about our present life. That is, the truth can give it value, interest, and purpose. But Peter is not talking about that sort of grace of life, is he? He's talking about being heirs. That is, we are waiting for a time when we shall obtain together immortality and carry our work together, sisters, beyond the present into the future, to labour together in the kingdom age. We are heirs together of the grace of life. And what he's really saying is that what you're doing now is a preparation that your prayers be not hindered. And where there is no submission in the home, there's not normally any family readings. And there's not normally any family prayers. And therefore there will not normally be the divine blessing that you and I want. Very significant, isn't it? The way he puts that. Now, I don't know what time I'm supposed to sit down, Brother Maynard. 12:30. Give me 5 minutes. 1 Timothy chapter 5. We read it. We better do something about it. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, a chapter which concerns principally the question of the caring for widows, which our chairman mentioned in his prayer, we have some very interesting statements made, and I think that this will help us to round off the ideas that we have tried to present here this morning. We read, for instance, in verse 7, in connection with the caring of widows and how the family should look after their own widows, these things give in charge that they may be blameless. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own kindred, he hath denied the faith, and is worse than an unbeliever. Now, sisters, the point I want to make about that is quite simple. It is this, that Paul places a nexus, a connection, between the domestic issues of life and keeping the faith. Now, every one of us, of course, has got to ask ourselves a little bit of a question about this. Because we don't always see that nexus, do we? We don't always see that there is, in the very domestic issues of life, a way in which we can either keep or not keep the faith. So that Brother Roberts once said, and we all know these words, that the bulk of issues in life which will see us into the kingdom concern the kitchen sink. That's basically a summary of what he said. It's how we conduct ourselves in the home that is the grounds of preparation for the future. And if we are not orderly and stable and diligent in the home, it may well be, not perhaps necessarily, but it may well be that we will not be orderly or diligent in the truth. And if we are, it may all be a waste of time anyway, because we're not keeping the faith. Well, we go on to verses 9 and 10. Let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man. Not a reference to keeping widows out of the truth, is it? We know that that's a reference to not taking into the number of widows who are to be cared for by the ecclesia, those under the age of 60 and who have had more than one husband. They are to be, verse 10, well reported of. Now you look at this list of qualifications before you can get assistance from the ecclesia. Well reported of for good works, that is, a wide reputation. If she have brought up children, had to be a mother. If she have lodged strangers, had to be hospitable. If she have washed the saints' feet, had to do the humble jobs around the ecclesia and at home. If she have relieved the afflicted, had to go and visit the sick and those in trouble. If she have diligently followed every good work. My, oh my, is that a broad qualification, isn't it, sisters? Before, the ecclesia was to be charged with the responsibility of looking after those who are widows. Because you see, the younger widows, verse 11, were to be refused, for when they have begun to wax wanton, that is, to live a life of luxury and gaiety, against Christ, that is, against what was required of those taken into the number cared for by the ecclesia, which was that they devote their entire lives to the service of the ecclesia, you can't expect to get something out of the ecclesia, sisters, until you've put something in, and unless you're prepared to continue putting it in. That's the principle Paul's talking about. Not a matter of saying, look, I've got an enormous debt to pay, and go to the ecclesia and say, can you pay the debt for me? If you've done nothing for the ecclesia, or done little for the ecclesia, the ecclesia is only bound to help when those qualifications are possessed, and on the basis that the help will mean that you'll devote your entire life to repaying in kind, with effort, the help that is given. That's the principle. So he says they had condemnation, verse 12, because they cast off their first faith, or that is, the promise that they would have had to have made in order to be assisted by the ecclesia. And they learned to be idle and to go about the business of tattering, etc. So he goes on to talk about what those widows, the younger widows, should do, but it also applies to those of us who are married, the sisters amongst us. Verse 14, I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, and give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. Now, the word to bear children there is a word in the Greek that means to be the mother of a family, and by implication includes all the duties of the maternal relation. In other words, it is a very wide term. The mother of a family, and therefore, by extension of the idea, to have responsibilities and duties in relation to that family. Can't just bear children and leave them, or leave them to someone else to care for while you go out to work. That's just not on. If you bear children, you bring them up. That's a scriptural injunction. You do not leave them in the kindergarten. You do not leave them in the creche. You do not give them to grandma and go to work. You bear them and you bring them up. That's the scriptural principle. Then he goes on to say, you've got to guide the house. Now you'll like this, sisters. The word guide the house means to have the management and direction of household affairs. And I work in a bank, and I quite often see applications come through where the occupation is required. And you know, it's amazing these days how many applications come in with a woman saying that her occupation is household manager or domestic manager or something along those lines. You know, even the apostle says that that is what you are. Really, that's what you are. You're not in charge of the house in the sense that the husband may be the head of the house and therefore responsible for the conduct of the house, but you are responsible for the management and direction of household affairs, chiefly those which will see growth and development in your children and will allow your husband the opportunity to labour as he should, both in the word and the doctrine and in the work of the truth. And if you do your job properly, sisters, and you stand behind your husband, you will contribute to the work of the truth in a way that is most valuable for the growth of the ecclesia. The husbands who haven't got that are handicapped. They are greatly handicapped. The husbands who have got it have got a breeze. And they're able to get on with the work of the truth and to do it well and to do it properly and without the problems that can sometimes be generated in the home by the wrong attitudes. That's the lesson of the apostle. And he warns in verse 15, some are already turned aside after Satan, listening to the voice of the flesh. That, sisters, is a warning that we've already alluded to quite frequently this morning. Let us then, as we go forth from this place today, take with us the counsel of the Apostle Peter. To develop within ourselves, sisters, a meek and a quiet spirit which manifests itself by diligence in the home. Because you know what? What you're doing today is your preparation for tomorrow. And Yahweh is not known for refusing the characteristics of those who have laboured before him and developed qualifications in the spirit of faith. He is not known for denying that. He uses those abilities. He uses those characteristics. And sisters of the ecclesias in Adelaide, he is, very shortly, going to use yours.